Okay, the next case on calendar today is Davis versus State, case number 61529. Justice Perigary is not here today, as you can see. He will participate fully in the deliberation by listening to today's argument on the tape recording and participating with me and Justice Seda in resolving the case. He extends his apologies that he could not be here. Something unexpected came up, and he regrets it. Are you prepared to proceed?
Yes, thank you. Today, on behalf of the appellant, Carla Butkoff, Brant Butkoff, I would like to begin the argument and reserve 3 minutes, and Brant Butkoff will conclude the argument.
Okay.
Also present is Tip Mentee, Elena Pernice, and we're prepared.
Great. Please do. Reserve 3 minutes.
May it please the court, counsel. This is a very interesting case. It seems that I draw the cases with the very strange sets of facts. This is one of those. I don't think this court will see this type of a set of facts in a very, very long number of years again. It's interesting to me because I attend the Federal Public Defenders, CLE, regularly, and I attend their ethics conference every December. And every December, in the 14, 15 years I've been doing that, the smoking gun is handed to defense counsel, and what will you do with it and why, is the ethical question on one of their exams. And that's what we have today. We have a very interesting set of facts. On September 9, 2011, officers respond to a residence in Mogul. On that particular date, the victim of this case, Gary, is his middle name, he goes by that. Gary was irrational. He was threatening the police. He threatened to shoot them with an AK-47. He asked them to kill him 3 times, shoot me. He was on the roof with a lawnmower blade, waving it. He was erratic. He'd already punched his brother in the face. Robert Davis, the defendant here, had a red mark on his face. The police believed him to be such a danger that they backed up on their location and moved a quarter to a half a mile down the road so that they could not be shot by Gary. This is less than 12 hours before the next turn of events. 2 months prior, Robert Davis was beaten up by his brother Gary with a bat. Gary was arrested. It's also notable that Gary had issues, mental health issues. He was bipolar. He was on medications. When he was off his medications, he would act irrationally, violent, outbursts of rage. This is the defendant's brother, so he's clearly aware. Unlike the cases with strangers, where we don't know what the defendant knew about the victim, this is a family member. Robert Davis knows that his brother has bipolar. He knows he's using meth. He knows he's irrational. He knows he's dangerous. Within 12 hours of this incident, he's actually hit by him, calls the police. The police don't arrest Gary that day, unfortunately. None of us would be here. Unfortunately, they leave, turn the case over, take Mr. Davis and say, don't come home. Unfortunately, again, Robert Davis does return to the residence. Interestingly enough, not only Robert Davis knows about the mental health issues of Gary, the neighbors do. They call him the crazy. He's irrational. He's frequently arguing and yelling, not necessarily with anybody, so they know his voice. The testimony of Mr. Roper is that Gary said, I'm going to kill you, to Robert Davis. I've got something now. He attributes those words to Gary. The action of Robert that night, he had been drinking. He met a Miss Rouse earlier in the evening. He was on the bus. He was intoxicated but not sloppy drunk, was her testimony. He was nice enough that she gave him her telephone number on a bus. He was wearing a baseball cap, a T-shirt, and there wasn't pepper spray on either of those items at that point in time. Now we flash forward to 1:30 in the morning. The neighbors awaken to breaking glass, yelling and screaming outside. One of the neighbors testifies to inside voice versus outside voice and the conversation that's going on. They call the police. At about 2 o'clock a.m., Gary calls 911 saying, I've been shot. 4 calls back and forth between 911 and emergencies, REMSA. Police didn't enter this house because they were afraid for officer safety. They had the call earlier in the day where Gary threatened to kill them with an AK-47. They didn't go in harm's way and enter the house. They waited for the SWAT team. That took 2 hours. Then the SWAT team waited to set up and get the robot in. That took another 2 hours. So we have almost 4 hours before the officers go in and find Gary, who by that time is dead. The police investigation in this case included 2 days of the teams being in the house. They collected all kinds of items, but not on the first day. It was the second day that they went back that they noticed a blood spot on the roof, that they took into evidence a can of pepper spray. And that's the day that they missed another set of shots that was up in the ceiling of the house by a shotgun. What's interesting is not the same shotgun that Gary was shot with. So we know there's another weapon. And in fact, when police go into Gary's bedroom, they have a .22 rifle, they have ammunition, lots of it. They have a knife that's found near his mattress. So we know that Gary has access to guns and knives. We also know that Robert knows this because he tells the police during his interview, I know he has guns and knives, and he tells them earlier on September 9th when they're there on the emergency call, he has guns and knives. At the time of death, the victim had methamphetamine, amphetamine, diazepam, and alprazolam in his blood. Two, of course, are illicit substances known to cause paranoia, known to cause rage, and known to not properly react with the health medical drugs he was properly prescribed. We also know that Gary had been previously institutionalized because of incidents of rage, but the jury doesn't get to know most of that. Most of that evidence is withheld from the district court improperly. The police then find my client.
Let me pause you there. What was, I mean, my understanding is the fact that he was under the influence of methamphetamine did come into evidence at trial, correct?
That did come in, but none of the effects of methamphetamine or none of the institutionalizations, the prior felony, the prior acts of domestic violence, the prior battery with a deadly weapon for the bat, none of those came into this jury.
But prior altercation 12 hours earlier than the one that produced the slaying, that came in but not the baseball bat, is that right?
Right, that the incident the day before came in and the jury was instructed as to that incident only they could consider the mental state of Robert Davis.
And the neighbor's statements that he was a lunatic or crazy, that came in?
Right. Some of those came in with the fact that they'd been, you know, back and forth, the police had been to the house a number of times. But the actual types of calls the police had been there on didn't come in, and the district court struck. Some of that evidence was heard and then stricken from the record, so we have to assume the jury didn't consider it because the court struck it.
Right.
And that's why this is a hard record to read, because it happened. Oh, wait a minute, take it back, stricken. And I tried to point that out in my brief.
Yeah, it is. It's a tricky record.
Yeah. Then we get to some of the cross-examination issues. We have Detective Palmer on the stand. Detective Palmer knows about this bat incident. And when defense counsel goes to ask, there's a sidebar. My favorite beast is a sidebar. But when we come back from the sidebar, the questions are dropped. So we know defense lost. We don't know what, how, or why. We have several of those incidents where we don't have an adequate record in this case. We're doing the best we can. So the first interview with my client occurs by an ambulance. The police then hold him, detain him, and tell him he has two choices. They don't want him to drive to Parr Boulevard because he's intoxicated. But they want him to go there and do an interview. So they double handcuff him, take him up to Parr Boulevard, and don't advise him of Miranda, and do an interview. The district court properly ruled that interview was improper under our Constitution. Then what happens is they let him go. They arrange and drop him off. The police arrange and drop him off at the Kerridge Inn, where they tell him, do you mind if we come back and talk to you later? They contact family members to have him pay for the Kerridge Inn, and they drop him off. And they do indeed come back later. They also post a guard, watch an undercover officer watching him to see if he's leaving. Was he free to leave the Kerridge Inn? Why did they post a guard if he was free to leave the Kerridge Inn? They delivered him. They returned, re-interviewed him. What was he thinking? a rational person who had just spent hours at the police department, been delivered to a location by the police, police outside waiting in a car, isn't going to think they're free to leave.
The police outside in the car?
Yes.
Were undercover?
I think they were undercover. They were detectives.
Nobody stood outside his door or anything of that nature?
No, it wasn't a marked officer just standing there, but they sat in the parking lot waiting to see what he would do. He slept.
Judge Freeman found that he was not in custody at the carriage in piece of the sequence.
Right.
And what standard of review applies to that determination by him?
Abuse of discretion. And the question for this court is, because the second interview was held to be unconstitutional,
right,
in violation of Miranda, did that taint the third? That would be our position, that it did.
That it's a continuation of the earlier?
Exactly. And especially under the circumstances that he didn't leave, and they all of a sudden found him somewhere else. They took him where they wanted him to be and said, do you mind if we come back and talk to you? And he slept off the fact that he'd been drinking. In the other interview, he was clearly intoxicated.
I'm interested also in your jury issue on the willfulness instruction, if you could comment on that.
Thank you. We see this in almost every murder case. We give a general willfulness instruction, and then contained within our first-degree murder, we give a specific willfulness instruction. The problem being that the willfulness is different for the second-degree, the voluntary manslaughter, and the manslaughter analysis. But if we get a jury who's not learned in the law, these instructions are very, very difficult for lawyers to understand. And then we tell them, here's willful, and here's willful.
But I have to review that on plain error, correct, on that?
Yes.
Because there's no recorded objection. We're back to the sidebar, off-the-record conversation.
We definitely are. That's one thing I would love to see this court do.
Well, we have the Palacio decision of a couple of months ago.
And I would love to see this court take it one step further, make it the obligation of the judge to have it done on the record. Obviously, defense attorneys are not going to listen to you. They've had 20 years of opinions where you've told them, quit it, quit it, quit it. In 20 years I've been reading these cases, they still sit in the judges' chambers with their feet up, off the record, discussing jury instructions. This court should simply hold the judge shall have the jury instructions held on the record. Done with this.
Is there anywhere in the record where they went on and said, well, there were no objections to the instructions? They were settled? They were agreed?
They went out on a Friday afternoon. They settled instructions in the judge's chambers on a Friday afternoon. Then the record stops. On Monday morning, the judge says, counsel, does anybody have any objections to instructions 1 through 41 as written? No, sir, no, sir. And they're given to the jury.
So you don't, to that extent, then, that was an acceptance, ostensibly, of the instructions.
Yeah, but I don't know what they argued about or what they might have had offered or put in, or what words they discussed, whether they even brought up the willful issue. Let alone, there's another jury question, too.
Yeah.
So in my time,
you're not, I'm sorry, rapidly, maybe we'll give you a little bit of extra time, because I'm going to ask a question about the jury instructions and the process by which they were ultimately, quote-unquote, placed on the record. At that time, do you feel that the judge would or would not have allowed an opportunity to say, Judge, I, based upon our discussions in chambers, I have no objection to instruction 1 through 40 other than those expressed in chambers?
Yes. And in fact, when judges in our district do this off the record, the first thing they do when they go back on the record outside the presence of the jury is say, counsel, you have requested instruction number A and the court's rejected it. We'll make a record. Please give us your argument. So even if they do them off the record, standard in the industry is to put it on the record at the next seating. And in this case, it didn't happen. And I was, frankly, I was shocked.
It didn't happen, or else there were no objections.
I don't know. I can't tell you that.
Okay. What I'm going to do, so that you have your full 3 minutes, is add a minute and 20 seconds. And I'll add the same to Ms. Noble's time.
Thank you so much.
Yes.
Good afternoon. May it please the court, my name is Jennifer Noble. I represent the state in this case. And before I begin, is there anything or any place in particular that Justice Pickering or Justice Seda, you would like me to address?
I'm interested, and we didn't get a chance to ask your opponent, with the prosecutorial statement in closing argument that is argued to have been an improper comment on the defendant's failure to testify. Could you comment on that?
Certainly. During his closing argument, the deputy district attorney indicated that no evidence came from the witness stand regarding self-defense, words to that effect. I think I pretty much got it. Now, the assertion, of course, is that this was an improper burden shift or comment on the defendant's right to remain silent. It was not. It is a correct statement of law under the Runyon case. When the defendant is going to set forth a theory of self-defense, he does have that initial burden before the state has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that self-defense wasn't something at play that should exonerate the defendant. And so Mr. Dreiling's comment didn't particularly say you didn't hear from the defendant that he was defending himself. There were many witnesses and a lot of evidence introduced that could have suggested self-defense in this case. And we were talking, or you were talking earlier about what the jury did get to hear in this case, that this decedent was referred to as the crazy, that they had had a domestic altercation earlier that day. But there was evidence that came from the witness stand that the defense tried to suggest would have supported self-defense, but there was no improper comment by Mr. Dreiling on the defendant's right to remain silent and not testify.
I'm also interested in the Carriage House interview and the judge's refusal to suppress that piece of evidence.
Okay. And an interesting question was asked as to how those previous police encounters informed the Carriage House situation. And first, I think it's important to note that there is no indication in the record, in fact, to the contrary, that the defendant in this case knew he was being surveilled. In other words, he gets a ride down to the, I believe, the sheriff's office. He's interviewed. He's handcuffed on the way down there, which the court doesn't like. And the products of that interview, that initial interview, are suppressed. But he's released after that, taken to the carriage, and I believe arrangements were made with his family because his parents didn't want him at home that night. So we have a defendant who doesn't know he's being watched. He knows he's in a motel room. He's sleeping with the door wide open. And the detective knocks on the wall and says, "Hello, are you in there?" And the defendant wakes up and says, essentially, "Come on in." And the length of time in which they're in there is approximately 30 minutes. So when we're considering whether or not he felt that he was in custody, he's already come down to the police station. He consented to come down there, but I understand there were other issues about his statements once he got there, was given a ride back, and now the police are back to chat with him again. There is no reason for the situs of this, or the site rather, of this questioning to suggest to this defendant that he was in custody. So if we go to whether or not he was the focus of the investigation, I believe under Allward, clearly he was the focus of the investigation. And then third, the length of the questioning. This was a consensual conversation with law enforcement, and the fact that it did end in an arrest doesn't convert it to a custodial interrogation necessitating Miranda.
Counsel, how many officers were in the room at the time of the interview?
I believe it was two detectives that were there, but I don't know precisely. So
any standing around outside that open door?
I don't know the answer to your question. I believe there were a couple of officers, and it may have just been Detective Palmer that was in there speaking to him.
At one point, Bruce did reference Detective Palmer and a colleague, so I think it's pretty safe for us to assume at least there were two. I was just concerned about those who may have been standing around outside in view of the defendant.
And I'm not sure if I know. I don't know the answer to that question precisely. I believe there were two detectives who did speak with him that day.
Thank you.
One of whom he had told earlier that you're the bomb. So he felt comfortable, at least to some degree, with those folks prior to being arrested, of course. Um, With respect to the jury instructions, Justice Pickering, you asked a question about the willfulness instruction. Earlier in the instructions, instruction 15 includes willfulness or a willfully definition that applies to the lesser included offenses. Remember, this was an open murder charge. So no intent to violate the law was necessary in order to find that somebody willfully did something. But instruction 20 and is very particular to first degree murder, which was the verdict in this case, and defines willful specifically as with the intent to kill. And there are specific instructions on express and implied malice premeditation that follow, and jurors are presumed to follow the instructions. So the jury was properly instructed in this case, and had it had a question or been confused, certainly they would have let the judge know that. I believe the way the instructions read, it was clear that with respect to the first-degree murder, the willfulness was accurately defined.
Is instruction 15 a conventional instruction?
I believe so, yes.
Okay. I mean, in the first-degree murder, in a case that has a first-degree murder charge?
It's conventional for our office.
Okay.
Thank you. My understanding, and it's one I've seen before, but conventional for the rest of the state, I'm not sure.
15 and 20 are not uncommonly given together, is your statement?
Yes, Your Honor. There is also, Ms. Buckhoe also discussed the issue of whether or not the detectives were allowed to testify at trial about prior instances of violence and the mental health history of the victim in this case. And it's framed as a confrontation clause violation, but what it really is, in the state's view, is simply a question of whether or not the court properly disallowed hearsay evidence. It was attempted to be introduced through witnesses who didn't necessarily have any personal knowledge of these particular incidents. And
I thought the conviction of the baseball bat domestic violence was offered and excluded, or am I mistaken on that point?
A prior conviction? That's not what I believe occurred,
okay.
Your Honor. But either way, that wouldn't be the proper way to try to get that prior conviction in. If you had a certified prior conviction, you could, of course, use it to impeach somebody or get it in some other way. But certainly, the jury heard about the prior incident that day and saw pictures of the defendant's reddened face in relationship to that domestic. You have a jury hearing that this victim's up on the roof saying, shoot me, and making, you know, pow, pow, pow noises at the police, and they're alarmed enough to set up a perimeter. And we know that the jury knew that he was
referring to. So your point is it would be gilding the lily at that point?
Yes. Yes. Very well articulated. Yeah. And besides, what we're looking at is whether or not this particular piece of information is properly offered through these particular witnesses.
Right.
And the state's position is that it simply was not.
So you're basically saying they didn't have an adequate proffer and it wasn't a categorical exclusion?
Yes.
Would you like to address the BBs in the ceiling?
Yes.
And
yes.
The off-the-record conversation that occurred without your client present, I guess it was on the record, but without her client present concerning counsel's ability to continue to represent him.
Yes, and I'm glad you asked that question and reminded me of it, because I think that this perhaps is the most interesting part of this fact pattern for me. We have the defense team going to the crime scene with their investigator, and they're present certainly when evidence, and the question is it material evidence? We would say the answer is no, is collected from the ceiling. So does that create a conflict of interest is a question. And two, is there anything wrong with the defendant not being present when that's being discussed? And in the reply brief, counsel talks about the Campbell case. It was originally a 2002 Ninth Circuit case in which the court found it to be structural error mandating reversal. But then what is not cited is Campbell 2 in 2005. The Ninth Circuit goes back and says, we would find that to be trial error, and it did not prejudice this particular defendant, and so it's harmless. And that would certainly apply here. That's the state's view. And, of course, we don't get another chance to respond usually after the reply brief. So our position with respect to the defendant not being there when they're discussing the potential conflict of interest is that he should have been there. But it doesn't matter. It's harmless error because it did not affect his substantial rights. Remember that the defense team talked about how they were concerned that this was harmful evidence to their client. In other words, it might support a felony murder theory, another angle by the prosecution, and that was their main concern. That concern was eliminated by the stipulation to not reference any of that. Now, it's often the case that prosecutors might go down to a crime scene, and they might be present while evidence is being collected. But that doesn't necessarily create a conflict of interest with respect to the prosecutor's ability to litigate that case. Similarly, in this case, if they needed to have evidence put on or testimony with respect to the discovery, had that evidence been material, which it was not, they simply could have put the defense investigator up on the stand. That would have been the remedy there.
And so the genesis of the conflict, theoretically, it's not entirely clear to me, but it's under the lawyer as witness rule that...
That's, as I understand it, that appears to be the argument, that they made themselves witnesses in their own case and that was improper under the rules of professional conduct. I don't agree with that. I think it wasn't a good idea, perhaps, to handle it the way that the defense team did. Nonetheless, it created no actual conflict of interest, and the defendant was not prejudiced by those incidents and the way the court handled them. And Judge Freeman did give a lot of opportunities to defense counsel to meet with him outside the presence of the district attorney to articulate perhaps whether or not the discovery of these pellets would support some other defense theory that they wanted to advance that they now felt was impaired. And they were pretty clear that that was not the case, that they were worried that the state would be using it against their client. I see I have additional time here, but I don't really have much else to say unless you have any questions.
I don't.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Justice Pickering, Justice Seda. I'd actually like to start out by talking about the jury instructions again. There is a case that we found called Keonis Davis, which the facts mirror almost exactly the facts of our case. One friend knew another friend, got into an altercation, got shot. The only difference is that this friend didn't die. So it went through, and a jury instruction was denied, a jury instruction for self-defense or battery. And this court found that failing to give that jury instruction was actually reversible error. Well, this could have occurred in our case. The problem is we don't know what the jury instructions were or if there were arguments. Perhaps there was a different theory put forth in jury instruction that would have been viable. We don't know. The lack of absence in any sort of record on this is horrible.
So do you think that this becomes an ineffective assistance of counsel challenge that's more appropriate for post-conviction relief?
I think it's both.
Okay. Tell me why it's a direct issue on appeal.
On appeal, it leaves us the absence of a record. We could do, as Keonis Davis did, a successful appeal on a jury instruction that was improperly given or one that was failed to be given. That could be a direct appeal issue. Also, the failure to have the judge, you know, go on the record is certainly an effective assistance of counsel claim. I think it hits on both levels.
Okay. And what's the citation of the case you were relying on?
That is Keonis Davis versus State of Nevada. And I have the case in front of me, but it doesn't. Oh, there it is. It's 130 Nevada, Advance Opinion 16. All right. I'd also like to talk about the words willingly as used in the jury instructions. Jury instruction 15 puts forth the word willfully, and it says as used in these instructions. As such, it applies to every instruction given to the jury. And then when you get turned to instruction 20, it says willfulness is the intent to kill. Now, these are two conflicting jury instructions, and neither one was limited, and neither one was said to be superior to the other. We can assume that the jury follows the instructions, But when the word is used two different ways and never limited, the jury can't follow two conflicting definitions at the same time. All right, I'd also like to talk about the bullets briefly, as I only have 40 seconds left. The claim that they are immaterial, I think, is patently false. The theory on our case is one of self-defense. Having extra bullets in the ceiling, of course, means that a gun has been fired before. And if a gun has been fired before, it could have been fired at Mr. Davis by Gary. Who knows what could have happened with those bullets? But the fact they were excluded, we don't know. It could have been shot at before, gives him a reasonable belief that Gary would actually fire upon him again. It goes directly to the defense theory, actually. And the assertion that it would go for a felony murder rule also can't be true because it's a different gun. This means that the gun he used that night to shoot Gary, of course, was not the gun used to fire bullets into the ceiling. So he couldn't have been firing those shots during the same night. All right. I believe my time's up. Thank you very much.
I want to thank you both. It was an excellent job on the briefs and argument. It's a very interesting case. Nice job, everyone. We'll be in recess until the further call of the court.